This is Culturetopia, your weekly roundup of the very best arts and culture stories from NPR. I'm Linda Holmes, editor of NPR's arts and entertainment blog, Monkey See.
And I'm Justine Kennan, a producer at All Things Considered.
Just a reminder, you can, as always, subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. This week...
Has shock value in music changed since the days of Elvis's swizzle hips and Ozzy Osbourne's bat biting?
We hear how the music of Motown was translated for international audiences.
And that ever-present summertime hit, Walking on Sunshine, endures the test of time. But first...
The actor Dennis Hopper died this weekend at his home in Venice, California. He was 74 and had been diagnosed with prostate cancer last fall. Hopper rose to fame opposite James Dean in the films Rebel Without a Cause and Giant. And in the 1960s, he helped define a generation in Easy Rider. He also played a series of indelible bad guys in movies ranging from Blue Velvet to Speed. But his life off-screen was at times even more dramatic. Jesse Baker has this remembrance.
Dennis Hopper started out a long way from Hollywood. He grew up in Dodge City, Kansas in the 1930s.
Well, I mean, I was raised at the end of the Dust Bowl, so I used to tell people the first light that I really saw was not from the sun, but it was from a movie projector.
That was Dennis Hopper on WHYY's Fresh Air in 1996. Dennis Hopper had a film career that stretched back to a 1950s Hollywood where studios still bound actors to contracts. And that's exactly the Hollywood scene Dennis Hopper wanted to be free of. The year was 1969, and Hopper's friend and fellow actor Peter Fonda had an idea. He wanted to make a movie about two freewheelers who ride their motorcycles from Los Angeles to New Orleans. So Fonda called Hopper.
And he said, "That's cool. What do you want to do?" And I said, "Well, you direct, I produce, we'll both write and act, and we can save some money." And he said, "You want me to direct?" I said, "Absolutely. You've got the passion, you understand framing, you go for it."
The film's settings were the wide open spaces of the Southwest. The soundtrack was 100% rock and roll, and the script, well, let's just say it was drug-inspired.
"No, man, like, hey, man, wow, I was watching this object, man, like the satellite that we saw the other night, right? And, like, it was just going right across the sky, man, and then... I mean, it just suddenly, it just changed direction and went, whizzing right off, man."
Hopper and Fonda discovered a newfound freedom in this low-budget self-made movie. Easy Rider became a trailblazer for independent films in the 1970s, and it was a huge box office hit. Money backing Hopper's next film came rolling in, as Hollywood hoped it had found its new golden boy director. But Hopper's next production, titled The Last Movie, would prove otherwise.
It's very hard to look at the last movie now.
Robert Sklar is a professor of cinema at New York University, and he says the last movie was a failure. Hopper lost himself in the editing of the film.
But it shaped his career in a way. He went from the top to the bottom in the space of about 2 years, and then he spent a lot of time trying to come back.
Addictions plagued Dennis Hopper on the set of the last movie and the year he spent trying to edit the film. Much of Hopper's legend as an actor is one of him trying to clean up, clear up, and make a comeback, as he said on Fresh Air.
"Being an alcoholic and a drug addict, it was so easy for me to point to, because I'm an artist, after all, it's okay for me to drink and take drugs because I have an excuse, and I can't cop to that excuse."
One of several comeback attempts for Dennis Hopper came in 1979. Francis Ford Coppola offered him some redemption as the photojournalist in Apocalypse Now. Peter Fonda said Hopper's role in the film and the real-life Dennis Hopper had a lot in common.
"He's intense. He can be very funny. He can be very wild and unpredictable."
And he largely played himself in Apocalypse Now.
"Who are you? Mm. Who are you?"
"I'm a photojournalist. I've covered the war since '64. I've been in Laos, Cambodia, Nam."
As a photographer, Dennis Hopper documented everything from hippie love-ins during the free speech movement in Berkeley to the 1963 March on Washington. As an actor, Dennis Hopper seemed most at ease as the outsider and at his best when he was playing the villain. His work in film spans a lifetime, but was far from an easy ride. For NPR News, I'm Jesse Baker.
Rock musicians have always tried to generate interest in their music by shocking people. Elvis swung his hips, Madonna swung everything, and Marilyn Manson named himself after a convicted murderer. NPR's Neda Ulubi wondered how much shock value has changed since Ozzy Osbourne supposedly bit the head off a bat.
Can you imagine if the internet had been around during that bat-biting incident? Screaming at the window. The story's something of an urban legend, and that's part of its power, says Tavia Nyong'o, a professor of performance studies at New York University. No one had cameras in their phones back then, so the shock came from repeating the story. Did you hear? Ozzy Osbourne bit the head off a bat.
Shock just works differently now, because that distinction between the live and the mediated is far more blurred.
Pop musicians have always played with shock value. Internet videos gave them a new way to deploy it. Three were recently banned or censored by MTV or YouTube. Hello, hello, baby, you called, I can't hear a thing. Telephone by Lady Gaga, Born Free by MIA, and Erykah Badu's Window Seat are all still easily seen online. Cultural critic Rhonda Penrice does see a difference between the way musicians used shock value in the 1980s and today.
I think that it's increasingly harder to shock people, but what is relevant with these three particular works is that they're by women. And I don't think in the time of Ozzy Osbourne that women could make as strong a statement as these three women are making now.
At least not in mainstream media. And the internet has changed what counts as mainstream. It used to be much harder to find the kinky images that used to be a shortcut to shock. Now you just have to Google them. It's also easier to access cutting-edge, avant-garde work, like the video by Matt and Kim that inspired Erykah Badu's. It begins with the singer strolling through Dallas.
It starts out very pedestrian. She's walking, it's all going good. Then she starts stripping.
By the time Badu is fully naked, she appears to get shot right where President Kennedy was assassinated.
I think that what was shocking about it was that she did it without permission, and she did it in a guerrilla style.
Professor Tavia Nyong'o says you find yourself looking for shock on the faces of the people she passes. I need you to want me. Nyong'o says the shock of the singer's nudity was amplified by her location in Dealey Plaza, a sort of hallowed ground, a site of profound shock in American political history. And he says that's what made it inspired.
Shock itself is part of our daily life. You know, the risk of a shock, of a terrorist attack or a natural disaster.
Our fear and anticipation of those kinds of shocks may sit closer to the surface than in Ozzy Osbourne's heyday. Terrorism is a theme in MIA's video, Born Free. Soldiers violently round up insurgents, all red-headed young men, and kill them. Nyong'o says as a political allegory, it sounds more fantastical than shocking.
Almost funny. I mean, it's hard to laugh at it directly, but when one describes it, you know, the U.S. Army going in and grabbing everyone who's red-headed and putting them into an internment camp, right? I mean, you can see the absurdity, if not the humor in that, right?
Nyong'o says MIA and her director, Romaine Gravis, are part of a long tradition of artists who use shock in the service of nudging people into considering real issues, ones that can be hard to talk about. Of course, some people shock just for the fun of pushing buttons. But that can have political consequences too, says a well-respected performance artist who admits to dabbling in shock.
I'm considered like a provocateur.
Meet Vaginal Davis. It may not surprise you to learn that his work plays on race, queerness, and gender. While that's well-trod turf in the shockosphere, Davis says real shock demands surprise, which in turn demands a kind of subtlety.
If you're trying hard to shock people, it just comes off as lame and tired.
Which is why if Ozzy Osbourne bit the head off a bat today, people would want to see the video. And even then, Ozzy bat truthers would probably have their doubts. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
Here's a familiar tune with a possibly unfamiliar twist. The Four Tops recorded this Italian version of I Can't Help Myself in 1966. They did the same in several other languages for many of their hits. Starting in the mid-60s, Berry Gordy, the legendary founder of Motown Records, had his biggest stars re-record phonetic versions of their hit songs in Italian, German, French, and Spanish for European markets. And a new compilation of these recordings has just been released. It's called Motown Around the World. NPR's Guy Raz spoke with the sole surviving original member of The Temptations, Otis Williams, and with the producer of the album, Harry Weinger, and asked them how it all got started.
I think it really comes down to Berry Gordy and his staff at Motown, particularly his sister Esther, who worked there in artist management, having the vision that Motown would not be just a little label out of Detroit, but a global force. And they started going and having meetings overseas as early as 1963. Thinking that perhaps these little records by these great singers and artists would mean something outside of America, and he was right. And so the local companies began requesting songs, and he went ahead and did it. They flew in, and Otis will tell you, they flew in people to help them learn the language.
Otis Williams, in 1965, Berry yes. Gordy had the Temptations record a German version of My Girl. Here it is. It's appropriately, it's titled Mein Girl. Wenn es regnet, seh ich Sonnenschein. Und mit einem Mann kann ich happy sein. You know, German just makes that song sound so much more romantic. Otis Williams, what was the story there? What did you say when Berry Gordy asked you to do this? Did you say, that's a little weird, or were you okay with it?
Oh, we were okay with it. You know, we wanted to grow, you know, because at that time Motown was, you know, really growing and coming into its own, that we wanted to be a part of whatever it would take to increase the Temps growing as well as Motown. So we were okay with it.
I just want to play the Italian version of the same song because it is, you just got to hear it. That's more like it. Otis Williams, you guys were taught to sing these phonetically. Did you guys sing it in any other language?
No, we didn't.
You didn't?
Just those two, right.
Not in Dutch or Chinese or any other language?
No, we didn't get that far. We would have loved that, but it was just German and Italian.
Otis, when you went into the studio to record these songs, did you have to do it again and again? Like, describe the process.
Well, actually, it didn't take us long to really learn it. You know, we rehearsed it before we went into the studio just to get the gist of it and what have you. But once we got in there, we did not spend too much time in the studio. You know, we knocked it out rather quickly. So, no, we didn't spend, like, at the beginning of Motown when we would record our own songs in English. Sometimes we'd be up to 40 and 50 takes. But, no, it never got to that amount of takes.
I want to hear a Marvin Gaye song. This is Marvin Gaye singing How Sweet It Is in German. Keep me down both heart, my little baby. Keep me down both heart, my little baby. Yeah, yeah. Wie schön das ist, dass du bei mir bist. Absolutely brilliant. Harry Weinger, what happened to these recordings for so many years? How did you get this project together? How did it come about?
Well, yeah, like I said, these singles were really only produced for the local market. And it was tough to find some of the masters. I mean, frankly, and I'm honest in the liner notes, for a few of the songs, we had to go from the original 45s, the vinyl. We had to clean up the vinyl because the tapes would have been shipped to Germany or to Spain or to Italy, the local office there, and some of them didn't come back. And you do what you can to make it sound like the original recording.
But they're great. I mean, they still work.
Yeah, that's why we wanted to do it. I think there was a consensus for many years among all of us kind of Motown fans saying, we got to get these out somehow. We got to figure this out, you know? And I remember the first time I met Melvin Franklin and Otis for the first time, the late, great Melvin, and he turned to me and he said, are you going to find me a copy of Bluebird? And that was the flip side of Mein Girl.
Wow.
That was one of the first things he ever said to me.
Wow. Yeah.
I just need to hear this song because I love it. I love them all, but this one, it just, wow, this one blew me away. Oh.
You can hear the full interview at npr.org/culturetopia.
25 years ago, Katrina and the Waves released their one-hit wonder, Walking on Sunshine. And since that time, just about everyone associated with the song has lived quite well off its success, NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports.
When people used to ask Katrina Laskanich what she did for a living, she'd say,
I'm a singer in a band, Katrina and the Waves. Oh, no, never heard of it. Walking on Sunshine? Oh, wow, yeah, of course.
After it was released in 1985, Katrina Laskanich says Walking on Sunshine became one of those It's Never Gonna Go Away songs around the world. And every time the song got played on the radio, it made a little more money. Tim Lee heads up Tummy Touch Records, Katrina and the Waves' current record label.
Every time you get the song played on the radio, you might make $1 or $1.50, and if the song is played 2 million times, as Walking on Sunshine has been, you know, it really adds up.
Katrina Laskanich, who'd been a dishwasher on an American military base in England, says it was a lot like winning the lottery. She says the band, wisely, decided to put themselves on a salary rather than get lump sums. Katrina was able to put a down payment on a small house and bought a new car.
The song became bigger than the group, and we did pretty much follow in the wake of its success.
But after a couple of years, the record label wanted another hit, just like Walking on Sunshine.
They thought we were the New Monkees, the Beach Boys, but we weren't even really that kind of band. We were a bit cooler. I thought I was Nico in the Velvet Underground and, you know, black turtlenecks and black eyeliner and no smiling in photographs.
So they were dropped. But the money from Walking on Sunshine kept coming in. In an otherwise move, the band held on to the publishing rights. That's the money that typically goes to the songwriter, the band's guitarist, Kimberly Rue. Tim Lee says Rue shares that money with the rest of the band. The song showed up all over the place. The movies American Psycho and High Fidelity and countless commercials. Everything from diapers to medicine.
It's another beautiful day.
Sunshine.
Don't lose it to seasonal allergies. Take control.
And don't it feel good?
Talk to your doctor.
Walking on Sunshine often was the crown jewel in EMI's catalog.
Jared Mason worked for EMI Publishing from 2004 to 2008. He says of the roughly 1.3 million songs in EMI's catalog, Walking on Sunshine was one of its biggest earners. He says advertisers would pay about $150,000 to $200,000 to use it for 1 year.
It has that sort of feel-good theme that can just be applied everywhere.
By some estimates, Walking on Sunshine has made the band Katrina and the Waves about $1 million a year over the last decade. How long did it take you to write Walking on Sunshine?
I'm just trying to remember.
Kimberly Rue has written over 200 songs since then, but he lives off the money from Walking on Sunshine.
If we had more songs which more people knew, I mean, that would be so much the better. I mean, basically, you know, we're lucky to have one.
The story of the original band, Katrina and the Waves, did not end well. Katrina Laskanich says she was fired in 1998. Lawyers were involved. She says she no longer gets a share of the money made from Walking on Sunshine, but she does still sing it.
I'm walking on sunshine. Whoa! And don't it feel good?
Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
And don't it feel good?
Finally, we end with more music. They called her the Lark of the Border. Lydia Mendoza was the first star of recorded Tejano Texas-Mexican music. She became a sensation in the 1940s and 1950s, taking her 12-string guitar and her clear, heartfelt voice throughout Latin America. She died 3 years ago at the age of 91, nearly forgotten. John Burnett has the story of Lydia Mendoza, one of NPR's 50 Great Voices.
She was born in Houston to Mexican parents who were part of the great wave of their countrymen who fled the revolution for South Texas. By the time she was 11, she was singing and playing guitar in the Mendoza family band. They performed in restaurants, street corners, barber shops, fiestas, anywhere they could pass the hat. They barely made enough to eat. The Mendoza family briefly followed the migrant trail, picking beets in Michigan, but they quickly learned that playing music paid better and was a lot easier on the back. With her clarion voice, muscular guitar style, and smoldering beauty, Lydia soon emerged as the star of the family ensemble. Her reputation spread. In 1934, she recorded this tango for the Bluebird Record Company, which was in San Antonio looking for undiscovered talent.
Pues fue la primera que me pidieron, porque estaba muy popular, y fue la que entré con suerte, porque fue mi bandera.
¿Fue la bandera de usted?
Sí, Mal Hombre.
As Mendoza tells it, Mal Hombre, Evil Man, became her signature song. The audience demanded it every night, and she continued to play it for a career that spanned six decades. At some point, she became known as La Alondra de la Frontera, the Lark of the Border, and every aspiring young Mexican-American singer wanted to sound like her.
My name is Rita Vidaurri. I was little and I remember, I get goose pimples. I remember Lidia Mendoza, La Alondra de la Frontera, and she would sing Mal Hombre. That was a song that made her famous.
Rita Vidaurri was one of Lydia's oldest friends and a successful performer in her own right. She sang torch songs at the Tropicana in Havana and posed as the leggy Jack's Beer Girl. Vidaurri, now 86, sits on the front porch of her tidy house in San Antonio, full of mementos of her music career. Vidaurri usually sang with an orchestra or a mariachi band. What made Mendoza different is that she stood on stage alone, with only her guitar as accompaniment. Mexican female solo performers were rare back then. But what also set Mendoza apart was her audience. She became known as the singer of the poor.
That's what they would call her. Lidia Mendoza, la cancionera del barrio. From the bottom, from the poor, from the barrio.
Alegre estaba la fiesta, se celebraba una boda.
My name is Chris Drockwitz, and I'm the owner of Arhuli Records. Lydia sang in the vernacular, which means in the people's way of singing, not the highly trained or theatrical performers. She sang like the Carter family. That's their natural self, you know?
Strachwitz's Arhuli label carries a half dozen Lydia Mendoza albums. He co-produced the acclaimed 1976 documentary about border music in which she appeared. It's called Chulas Fronteras. Perhaps what made Lydia Mendoza the first great Tejana star was her approach to every song she ever sang. She describes it in his film.
A mí no importa sea un corrido, un valse, un bolero, polka, o lo que sea. Cuando yo canto esa canción, como diría, parece que yo vivo aquel momento.
It doesn't matter if it's a corrido, a waltz, a bolero, a polka, or whatever. When I sing that song, she says, I live that song. Late in Mendoza's long career, though her crowds had diminished, she began to be recognized for her tremendous contributions to Mexican-American music. She received nearly every accolade available to a Tejana artist, culminating with the National Medal of Arts in 1999. Few Tejano artists are aware today that it all started with Lydia Mendoza. John Burnett, NPR News.
That's it for this week.
You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I'm Justine Kennan.
And I'm Linda Holmes. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia.